Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Daniel Ellsberg, a one-time U.S. military analyst, best known for leaking the Pentagon Papers, who reflects on the White House drive for war with Iraq and growing dissent within the government bureaucracy. Former Yale University chaplain and Vietnam-era peace activist William Sloan Coffin, who assesses today's growing peace movement opposing a second Persian Gulf War. And Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners magazine, who summarizes an 11th-hour religious initiative to avert war with Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The London-based Independent newspaper and the British Medical Journal recently reported that Nestle, once the target of an international boycott because of its sales practices, and Danone have routinely violated a 20-year-old code by marketing expensive baby formula in the West African nations of Togo and Burkina Faso. These African states suffer from some of the highest rates of infant mortality in the world. Health experts estimate that nearly 10,000 infants die every year in these two nations because women are encouraged to use baby formula and shun breastfeeding their babies. In much of the developing world, breastfeeding is still viewed as backward, an image cultivated by baby formula manufacturers. In reality, breastfeeding is seen as the healthiest and safest way to nourish infants. Researchers from Helen Keller International, a New York-based charity, discovered free samples of baby formula in West African health clinics, a clear violation of the formula marketing code. Over 40 products, including fruit juice and infant cereals, also broke labeling standards. Victor Aguayo, who conducted the study, said, "At a time when it can mean the difference between life and death, mothers in the developing world need reliable and objective information on child feeding." In May 2001, Assistant Surgeon General Thomas Novotny got a late-night phone call from his superiors in the Bush administration. A holdover from the Clinton era, Novotny was in Geneva negotiating a global framework convention on tobacco control to reduce cigarette smoking. But Novotny's new boss in the Bush administration, William Steiger, the director of the U.S. Office on Global Health, issued new instructions to fight all restrictions on tobacco advertising, oppose any new tobacco tax, or any restriction on secondhand smoke. According to Mother Jones magazine, the call came after months of behind-the-scenes lobbying by the U.S. tobacco industry, which last fall announced it would oppose any treaty that puts limits on cigarette advertising as a violation of free speech. Meanwhile, nations in Europe, Asia, and Africa are pushing for a strong global treaty. The current draft revision calls for a ban on tobacco ads and new taxes on tobacco. Novotny, who was later replaced by the White House, says as far as the administration is concerned, the tobacco treaty is dead in the water. He added, "Getting anything signed by the president that has any teeth would be unlikely." Last spring, immigrant workers at the Seattle-Tacoma International Airport who work for Sky Chefs were told to show up for a company meeting. As it turned out, the workers met with undercover agents from the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. 12 of the Sky Chef's workers from Mexico were arrested and charged with immigration violations. The INS raid coincided with contract negotiations between Sky Chefs and Local 8 of the Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union, or HERE. According to the Progressive magazine, the airport raid was part of Operation Tarmac, the federal government's push to increase security at airports. HERE Local 8's Dana Wise complained, "None of the food service workers arrested by the INS had access to the tarmac, and all of the food they make is subject to security checks." Labor historian Peter Ratchlett notes that service workers at airports were making wage gains prior to the September 11th terrorist attacks. Now immigrant workers are subjected to exhaustive background checks, which sometimes cause workers with legal status to lose their jobs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
We'll bomb them till they're not there anymore.
Munitions factories are working overtime.
The United Nations gave the Allies the go-ahead to wage war. It is now powerless to stop it.
We have the entire United Nations behind us.
Officials give ear that public support for the war may not be enough.
The insanity.
There won't be any restrictions.
The entire
Daniel Ellsberg was a career U.S. government military analyst when in 1971 he leaked the now famous Pentagon Papers to the press, the 47-volume Defense Department internal study of the U.S. role for more than three decades in Southeast Asian conflicts was classified top secret. The documents chronicled the lies and deceit employed by government officials to justify U.S. military intervention in the region's wars. Mr. Ellsberg, originally a strong supporter of the Vietnam War, became a committed opponent, risking his career and freedom when he released these documents to the New York Times. He was indicted by the Nixon administration for the unauthorized release of state secrets and faced a possible 115-year prison term. But the charges were dismissed in 1973 after it was discovered that President Nixon had authorized White House aides to burglarize Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in an attempt to discredit him. In an indication of growing internal opposition to the Bush administration's plans for a preemptive war on Iraq, several career State Department diplomats have recently resigned in protest. In Britain, an intelligence agency operative leaked a document from the U.S. National Security Agency outlining plans to spy on United Nations delegates from nations whose votes are being sought by the U.S. to pass a resolution authorizing war in the Security Council. British authorities recently arrested an employee at the government communications headquarters for violation of that nation's Official Secrets Act. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Daniel Ellsberg, who reflects on the current White House drive for war with Iraq and growing dissent now bubbling to the surface within the government bureaucracy.
I think we are in a situation right now in which we're being lied into a reckless, unnecessary, wrongful war, just as happened in Vietnam. And in this time, there is a difference. We know we're going into a war. The public was misled even as to that 35 years ago. But this time we know, but why are we going into the war? Why Iraq? Why at this particular time? What is the urgency of it? I think the reasons being given by the president and his subordinates, his cabinet officials and sub-cabinet officials, are as misleading as ever were uttered during Vietnam. And I think there is a time right now for people inside the government to be telling the truth to us right now before the bombs are dropping. They shouldn't wait as long as I did before they decide to risk their careers or even give up their careers and tell what they know to the public, because there's a chance now of actually averting that war. It's a very small chance, but it's any chance is worth a great personal risk.
Daniel Ellsberg, there are people now within the State Department and other branches of civil service who are resigning and leaking information. John Brady Kiesling, a longtime U.S. diplomat in Greece, recently resigned in opposition to the Bush policy on war with Iraq. What can you tell us about what drives people inside the bureaucracy to take such a step?
Well, to take the step, it's not in a way so hard to explain. What's harder to explain is a way in which so many of them, like myself, spend years when they do know that the policy is wrong and they know that the president is misleading the people, and they keep their mouths shut. Looking back on it after the tragedies, one asks, I think very reasonably, what took you so long? But people used to ask me, you know, what gave you the right to put out these secrets? And I did feel, in addressing that question very often, that I should be asked the question, what made you think you had the right to keep your mouth shut all those years, even though, granted, your job depended on it? And was that a good enough reason? There are other reasons. I think why more people don't do what Kiesling, I think very creditably, just did, resign, and not only resign, but tell the public why he had resigned. Give a letter to the president, which he then shared with the public on his very frank reasons about the policy, which he thinks is extremely misguided and will endanger us. I really admire him for doing that. One other thing that he could do, actually, I imagine, as a long-term diplomat, is actually testify to Congress with the help of documents, or certainly describe the documents he's seen. And I hope he sees fit to do that, or that our people do it. There haven't been so many resignations yet, although I understand there's a number that are being threatened in Britain right now.
Daniel Ellsberg, after the September 11th terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington, the Bush administration has certainly used that to its advantage to attempt to gain public and international support for its war with Iraq, saying that they have weapons of mass destruction that could fall in the hands of terrorists. You want to address that rationale for this war that the White House is now planning?
Well, of course. course, anybody who possesses that weapons can let them loose or give them or lose control of them somehow to the hands of other people. And that's why these weapons are extremely dangerous in anyone's hands, including our own. By the way, we have enormous stockpiles of nerve gas, probably 10,000 tons or more, and we have stockpiles of biological weapons, it turns out. Is it good for Saddam Hussein to have that, as he probably does? Certainly not. The question is whether the risks are greater attacking him or less. And I think that attacking him makes it far more likely that he will, in fact, give that material in the short run to Osama bin Laden, or I should say to his forces, al-Qaeda. That's the judgment of CIA Director George Tenet last fall, who said that he was very unlikely to share that material with anybody that he couldn't control, which includes al-Qaeda, if he wasn't attacked. But that if he was attacked, it was a different matter, that he probably would share it. That's what we're facing right now.
Daniel Ellsberg, we have seen an incredibly powerful protest movement organized across borders over the last 6 months, and international coordination of this movement that is kind of unprecedented. Do you want to comment on how that came together and the future of such a movement?
I'm very happy to see that it has come. This is a unique period, in a way, in which the entire world is rising up, and I don't mean everybody, but I mean all over the world. We do see tens and hundreds of thousands of people daily and weekly almost protesting this foolish and wrongful policy by one of their member, namely the United States, our government, and that's true of many Americans as well. The protest is much larger than we ever had in this country before a war. It's larger than any country's ever faced before a war, and no country has ever faced the international protest of an aggressive war that this one is right now. Possibly 6 million people who marched around the world, and perhaps more than that, on February 15th. There's nothing corresponding to that anywhere. Now, I'm very glad to see it. I hope it will restrain us from this war, although it's unlikely to do that. I must say my first reaction is that everybody can see what this handful of people in the White House seem to have such trouble seeing, that this is a very mistaken and wrongful occasion for killing other people in Iraq, which we're on the verge of doing.
That was Daniel Ellsberg, whose release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971 bolstered opposition to the Vietnam War. Ellsberg's book, Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, is published by Viking. Visit Daniel Ellsberg's website at www.ellsberg.net. As the nation moves, seemingly inexorably, toward war with Iraq, a voice that inspired millions of Americans and university students in their opposition to the Vietnam War was heard once again on campus. William Sloan Coffin, Jr., the chaplain at Yale University from the mid-1950s through the turbulent early 1970s, came back to Yale recently to open an exhibit dedicated to peace activism. Coffin had been at the forefront of various movements struggling for social justice for half a century. He is best known for his support of draft resistance, for which he was indicted, tried, and convicted in 1967 as part of the Boston Five, along with Dr. Benjamin Spock and three other activists. They faced the possibility of 5 years in prison, but the conviction was overturned on appeal. Coffin, now 78, lives in retirement in Vermont, but he is still active in the peace movement. Coffin spoke at Yale in late February in conjunction with the opening of an exhibit at the undergraduate library titled Give Peace a Chance. The exhibit highlights peace movements from World War I through the late 1980s anti-nuclear weapons campaign. But its main focus is the Vietnam War, and the heart of the exhibit is memorabilia from Coffin's recently cataloged papers, which he donated to Yale. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with William Sloan Coffin, who assesses today's movement opposing a U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and the possibility of a revival of a military draft.
I don't think there will be a draft. The president is smart enough to avoid it. I don't think we'll need a draft to have a lot of agitation, particularly if the war goes badly. There's been so much agitation now. The fantastic demonstrations from coast to coast and a lot in small towns have aroused enough people's interest and anxiety that if the war goes badly, things will go very badly quickly for Bush and company, I think.
as I'm sure you're aware, Charles Rangel has proposed bringing back the draft. And I think partly to mitigate the poverty draft that currently exists and also to promote anti-war sentiment. Would you support bringing back the draft for either one or both of those reasons?
Well, Rangel's a very smart congressman, and I'm sure he wants the draft to offset the obvious fact that the poor once again are carrying the burden of the war. And secondly, because it would be an anti-war measure. Yeah, I would support it immediately, but I'm not very optimistic about it.
Would you support it on fairness grounds as well as trying to promote anti-war sentiment? That is there any reason why, you know, were people who are in college or have the economic means to not have to go into the military as their only option? Do you think that it would be more fair if other people had to confront that?
I think the argument the Pentagon advances that they have the people trained now who can wage the war is probably sound because it's so specialized, so much is bombing, so much is computerized, so forth, that the vast numbers of individuals are not needed, not yet.
Do you know Joe Lieberman personally?
Yeah.
One of the things in the exhibit is, very sloppy little leaflet that's just got a few sentences on it, and it's for a call for a May Day anti-war, a strike, basically, a student strike to come out to the Green on, I think it was May 7th of 1971, and he was listed as one of the speakers. And he was quoted in the Yale Daily News after that. He did speak there, and he said that he wasn't going to speak because he thought the Vietnam War was far from his concerns as a state senator, and then he changed his mind and said that because of the economics of the war, that's kind of draining, you know, funds for social programs. Do you want to comment about either then and or what you think of him now in terms of the role he's played?
I knew Joe Lieberman when he was editor of the Yale Daily News, and his ethical instincts were way above his political instincts. Now the reverse is true. As you can see, I'm very disappointed in Joe. His argument then about the economics of war is certainly very, very valid now. 40 or more city councils have passed resolutions saying we can't afford this war. And every state budget is written in red ink. We have absolutely no business spending the amount of money we are spending now on a war when there's so much suffering every day, more and more of it in the country. It's absolutely shocking. You know, with Bush's economy, if you take the money from the poor and give it to the rich, you have an economic plan. Now, if you take money from the rich and give it to the poor, you have class warfare. Now, Mr. Bush is sitting pretty. He deplores class warfare while making sure his class wins.
He still has fairly high approval ratings.
What,
do you want to comment on that? Why do you think that's true? It's just because of 9/11?
I think it's a lot of 9/11 counselors' popularity and these pious, patriotic platitudes about we're doing this and great American moral tradition, like Johnson used to say in the 60s, we're serving the cause of freedom. Too many people buy that. Too many people buy into the cult of presidential infallibility. For instance, most Americans, according to polls, say that they believe that Al-Qaeda and Iraq were associated back in 9/11. There's not a trace of intelligence to verify. But seeing Bush says it, too many people believe it.
That was former Yale University chaplain and peace activist William Sloan Coffin. For more information on Yale's Give Peace a Chance exhibit, call area code 203-432-2798 or visit Yale's website at www.yale.edu.
Thank you.
Across the globe, religious leaders are speaking out against the Bush administration's plan for a U.S. war with Iraq. The Pope, an outspoken opponent of this war, has sent emissaries to meet with heads of state, including President Bush, in an effort to avoid war. Representatives of many U.S. Christian denominations recently traveled to London, where they met for nearly an hour with British Prime Minister Tony Blair in an attempt to avert what they believe will be an unjustified and unpredictable second Persian Gulf War. Thus far, the same delegation of religious leaders has been turned down by the White House for a requested meeting with President Bush. Reverend Jim Wallace, the editor of Sojourners magazine, was among the American clergy who met with Prime Minister Blair and who have since drafted an 11th-hour initiative that they hope can prevent war. The six-point plan, titled An Alternative to War for Defeating Saddam Hussein, a Religious Initiative, proposes intensified weapons inspections, the indictment of Saddam Hussein for war crimes, revival of Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations, and humanitarian aid for the Iraqi people. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Reverend Wallace, who summarizes the peace initiative he calls a third way between war and ineffectual responses, and discusses why he believes a preemptive war against Iraq will unnecessarily cause widespread bloodshed and fuel terrorism.
Five of us went to London and met with Tony Blair. He gave us about an hour of his time. It was a very good conversation. And we talked about moral issues involved here, and I pressed him hard on trying to find a third way. And since we've come back, we've been working on what the third way might be. What I mean by that is, Scott, is the nation is torn right now between two great fears. There's a fear of war and all of the terrible consequences that could result from this war, high casualties, American lives lost, Iraqi civilians, instability in the Middle East, more anti-American resentment, more terrorism, the high cost, all the rest. There's a second fear, though, and that's the fear of weapons of mass destruction, especially if they could fall into the hands of suicide bombers and terrorists. And so that is also a great fear. Mr. Blair is feeling that fear profoundly. So several of us in the last few days put together an initiative. It's a six-point plan that tries to deal with both these fears and indeed talks about the legitimate goals of disarming Iraq and, in fact, regime change, removing Saddam Hussein from power, which I support, and yet protecting the people of Iraq, not bombing the children of Baghdad because of the offenses of this terrible dictator. It's very simple. It's one, indict Saddam Hussein. Indict him, send a clear signal that he will have no part, no future in any solution regarding Iraq. Set in the motion internal and external forces that would remove him from power. Make it clear that he has to go. Second, do much more coercive, intrusive inspections. Make the whole country a no-fly zone. Have this military force not be an invasion force, but an enforcement of UN resolutions and inspections. Go wherever they want, find anything they can and destroy it. But again, not bomb the children of Baghdad. Three, humanitarian aid right now, not after the war, but now. The country is in terrible shape. A war would make it much worse. Let's help the people now and show that we care about them more than Saddam Hussein does. Four, let's put a Middle East roadmap to peace on the table now. The British are very concerned about this. Mr. Blair and Claire Short, the Secretary of State, met with us. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is still at the heart of so much of the resentment. Let's put a roadmap to peace on the table now. Five, let's talk about a democratic Iraq not run by an American general as a viceroy in an occupied Arab land, a formula for disaster, but a UN administration that leads to constitution and democratic elections. And finally, let's focus on the real threat to this nation, which is not really Iraq, but shadowy networks of terror, Al-Qaeda, still out there. Let's refocus our attention on them. 6 points that I think would begin to raise up a third way. We've had a tremendous response so far, and we're hoping that we have enough time left to talk about a better way than war.
Reverend Wallace,
The White House scenario for a war with Iraq is one of very happy, thankful Iraqis coming out into the streets and kissing U.S. soldiers, and that the liberation of Iraq will vindicate the Bush administration's drive for war. But there are other scenarios out there. What are some of your concerns if your efforts and other efforts out there cannot prevent a war?
Well, I don't believe the Iraqi people have any affection for their leader. I think most of the Iraqis would be quite happy to see Saddam go. I'd be very happy to see Saddam go. The question is, what is the cost in human lives here? And is this the only way, the best way to do this? We indicted Milosevic a long time ago, and we didn't know when we indicted him how we could arrest him and detain him and finally incarcerate him if he saw him guilty. But we did so by sending a signal. We could do that with Saddam and target the dictator and not the people. But if we don't do that, we make war. You hear Pentagon talk now about Iraq will experience shock and awe. What does that mean, shock and awe? 3,000 bombs in the first week. The UN says there could be 500,000 casualties here. I think the dangers here of just humanitarian disaster, the refugees that are predicted, the relief and development organizations, Oxfam and all these organizations are terribly concerned about what's going to happen. You know, Gary Hart was just on Larry King, and he was saying that he thinks there would be just a whole new level of terrorism against the United States. The American people are not ready for that kind of cost. So I think these sort of very cavalier, some of them, and optimistic scenarios say more about American overconfidence and even hubris than any serious hard-headed evaluation of the real human, economic, and political cost, which I think would be great. I think until that war starts, there is a chance to stop it. And that's up to us to be citizens right now. The time to be engaged citizens is right now in these last remaining weeks.
That was Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine. Contact Sojourners by calling area code 202-328-8842. Read the Religious Peace Initiative online at www.sojo.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.